How are you going? Have I exhausted you?
Nothing.
Vigorous.
I know.
Page 2, number 4. The book of Exodus is, if you like, to use a modern analogy, is Israel's religious constitution. Nations are funny entities, peculiar entities. We're so used to the whole idea of nationhood, and so important for us in the modern world, in fact, modernism and nationhood go together, that we don't realise, number one, what a difficult institution a nation is, how late in human history they came about, and how precarious the existence of any nation actually is. It's, if you like, I think, probably the most important modern institution. It's taken over from the family, church, tribe, guild, many other things. It is the preeminent of all institutions. It's so much part of the scenery, the furniture of our modern life, that we seldom reflect on what is it that makes a nation a nation. Now, if I think historically, nations began where you got a group of people coming together that had shared a common ethnic origin, ethnic background. You had family, clan, tribe, and then you get tribes coming together who have a common ethnicity. And part of the device of bringing various tribes together was to find a common ancestor for the tribes, a common ancestry. We still have some nations that are basically, their definition is primarily in terms of ethnicity. So, for example, Japan is a predominantly ethnic, its identity is predominantly ethnic. But the United States and Australia has no common ethnicity. If that was what held you together, there'd be no hope for us. Israel, despite its appearances, is not really a ethnic community. It has a common ancestor, ancestors Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But if you read the account closely, you'll find out that it's not just the tribes of Israel that came out of Egypt, but there was a mixed rabble that came out. There were other people who attached themselves to it. And then throughout the whole of Jewish history, there are proselytes, people who have no ethnic connection, who become part of Israel. And there's no reason why this can't happen. So Israel is not predominantly an ethnic community in the Old Testament. Secondly, another thing that sometimes makes for a nation is to share a common culture and a common language. And they tend to go together. It's very difficult to have a common culture if you don't have a common language. It's a bit unlikely that there's some problems with the linguistic question, because throughout Israel's history, we know, despite the fact that the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, well, actually all of it isn't written in Hebrew, some parts are written in Aramaic. And there's bits and pieces of other stuff too. There's never one particular language and one particular culture that welded Israel together. If you think of it, Abraham comes from Ur of the Chaldees, one culture, one language. then goes up to Haran, another culture, another language, and then comes to Canaanite territory. What language would he be speaking there? Canaanite language, which is a precursor to Hebrew, and we know much more about it now because of archaeological discoveries, particularly the Rosh Hashanah texts, great resource for Old Testament study. Then when they were down in Egypt, okay, they were a bit of an ethnic enclave, even though they were called Hebrews. Hebrew was not an ethnic linguistic term, I won't go into it, but was basically a social, most likely a social designation. They would most likely have spoken Egyptian in some form there, or some other Semitic language. There were Semitic communities in the delta, the top of Egypt. Then they come into the promised land, and their language is Hebrew, what we call Hebrew. And in its classical form, it assumes its present shape about 900 to 600 BC. But however, then in the post-exilic period, the dominant language ceases to be Hebrew, except it's a religious language. It becomes Aramaic. New Testament times, it's Greek. And yet you have one language, I mean, you have one nation across all these languages. And then from a cultural studies point of view, there's enormous differences, cultural differences, say, between Israel 100 BC to Israel 200 BC or something like that. Yes, please, Gifford?
Well, what about even within the 12 tribes?
Yes.
I mean, could you say that there are great cultural differences?
Huge cultural differences, you know, and linguistic differences.
Ephraim and Judah, for example, or even yep. Other tribes.
There's an interesting story about one tribe trying to hunt down another tribe, and they would identify whether they came from the north or not, whether they had said Shibboleth or Sibboleth. Now, from which we get the modern idea of certain shibboleths. But there were significant linguistic differences, and even more important linguistic differences, cultural differences between the north and the south, hence the division. And the only way they managed to get the north and the south together was around a common worship, because there was just too many other cultural and also linguistic differences between the north and the south. There's some very nice linguistic work being done on trying to find out, you know, from traces of evidence that we had of some of the linguistic differences between north and south. There's a whole, a science of not just comparative linguistics, but historical linguistics, which in many ways is still in its infancy, and is being revised all the time because of finding new texts and so on. So it's not a common language or common culture that establishes Israel as a community. Although you say, can you say that America is a... As a country, has a common culture, common language? I don't think you can anymore. Or I don't know if you ever were. Do you realise that sometime in the 1800s, English was not the dominant language? There were more German-speaking people in America, the USA, than there were English-speaking people. And it's rapidly happening now that America is becoming not an English-speaking country. In practice, it's still the official language. And I don't see it ever changing, but it's rapidly becoming a bilingual country. The Spanish is becoming more and more predominant. And as for culture, apart from the superstructure, what strikes me as an Australian coming here is that you don't have one culture or one country, but it's not the, what's important is the united part of the states, not the, no, states rather than the united part. The culture, say Midwest here is totally different to California, with apologies to Todd and what I've seen of New York and up in Minnesota, different cultures. Now, in modern terms, the next two things are the things that basically are the determinative factors. A nation is a group of people, despite their varied linguistic background, despite their different ethnicities, despite their difference in culture, they live on a defined piece of real estate, land. So British is are the people who live on Great Britain, and there's enormous variety there. And some of the entities that are established are completely artificial, you know, where you put the boundaries. You can see this most terribly in Africa, where the colonial powers put the boundaries all in the wrong places and split various groups and throw other incompatible groups together. But the normal thing is it's land, and this is very ancient. Land, it's the land which determines nationhood. So I think, say, if you look at a country like China, okay, who or what's a Chinese person? It's a person who lives within that territory. And then you have the second thing, and that you have a centralized, unified political system, government. So land and politics determines things. Now, those are, land has always been important, but political systems, and to have political systems that can get people of many, many different interests and backgrounds working together is a very, very modern invention, and it's very, very precarious. In fact, as far as I know, the Chinese pioneered the nation state long time before we ever had nation states in Europe. But to the present time, one of the fears of the Chinese leaders is that the whole country will disintegrate. That's the big fear. The big fear of your deep thinking, deep thinkers politically, is that the USA will disintegrate politically because there's so little that's holding you together. Well, Israel never had, except for a short period of the monarchy, it never had a unified political system. Until the monarchy, it was a tribal system, which is not really a political system. It was a real difficult, unwieldy political system. They had political independence from the time of, let's say, Saul through to the exile. And even there were periods in that when they were basically dominated and colonialized by other empires. I won't go into the history of this. Well, what is it that... and Israel became a nation, a people, even before they came to the land, before they had kingship, before you had a unified system of tribal system with identified tribal territory and all that. Israel was a nation already before it came to the promised land, already before it had kings, already before it had a unified tribal system. What is it that right from the beginning unified Israel? It is the divine service. It's religious unity. If you like, liturgical unity. It's the liturgy, the divine service, ritual that unifies the people of Israel. And so too with the church. What is it that combines, unites you and me? I'm Australian, you're American, we have Chinese here, we have other ethnicities here, or country people. We had Moses before, that's Kenyan. What is it that unites us? It's the divine service. I'm thinking here now sociologically, but also this has theological implications. Now, if you ask the Israelites what distinguished them from all other nations, they had very little difficulty in saying what it was. If I can say, first of all, what would have struck pagan people about Israel. It's interesting to put yourself, say, in the shoes of a cultured Babylonian philosopher, say, who came to Jerusalem about, say, 650 BC. There's much in the country that he'd find, you know, be very, very similar. There was kingship. It was primarily an agrarian society. The way they ran the country was not much different to the way Babylon was run, except Babylon was at the centre of the world empire. But this one thing that would have struck your perceptive Babylonian right from the beginning, and if you had any sense whatsoever, it would hit him in the face. It's the same thing that strikes me when I go to India or Thailand or Bali. And it would strike me straight away, and it works both ways. I'd come and meet Stephen here, and the first thing that would strike me is that he's not wearing what I'd expect him to wear. He's not wearing any amulets. He's wearing a ring, but there's nothing on the ring. He's not wearing some amulet or lucky charm on the ear or the nose or over the forehead or on the lips or on his hand. The right hand's very important. And if I pulled up his shirt, it wouldn't be on his belly button. There's not a lucky charm on the toe. Now, and that indicated a far deeper, more important and significant difference. If you looked around, there would be no shrines in every street. And there'd be, you know, to put it in theological terms, there's a total absence of anything to do with what we call the occult. Anything to do with magic, whether it's white magic, black magic, amulet, because all the things that I've been touching on this body, jewelry, and also another thing, there'd be no tattoos. People wouldn't have any tattoos. What would people tattoo on their bodies? They'd put emblems of their gods to defend them against the demons. Why would they put rings on their noses? To stop the demons from getting in, or their ears. Why would they put a lucky charm on their finger? To make sure that they don't have bad luck in their work, that things turn out successfully, etc. Why would almost every woman, many women in the ancient world, well, wear a ring or something on their belly button, or sometimes on the vagina, to protect the woman from bad luck, demons? Now, everywhere in the ancient world, except Israel, you are confronted by the occult. Magic, sorcery is the substructure everywhere. Now, so that's going the pagan way to Israel, but the Israelites wouldn't have said that. They would give, as far as we can gather, there were three predominant answers that they gave, and they're all found in the book of Exodus. Can we get you to read them? First of all, chapter 19, 5 to 6. Would somebody please read that for me?
Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, and you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. And for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel.
But all nations belong to God, but Israel is God's private property. And what is Israel to God? What kind of a nation is it? A holy nation. Now, I want you to keep that. The rest of what we're going to do is to unpack what is meant by Israel as a holy nation. A royal priesthood, or the priests of the king, is merely a further exegesis of what's meant, what the function of Israel as a holy nation is. So God chose them from all the nations of the earth. They all belong to God. But Israel has a unique role. Israel has not just a political mission. Israel has a liturgical mission, a holy mission. The second answer, all these three ones are not excluding each other, but they're all saying the same thing. Let's go to God's discussion and Moses' discussion with God on Mount Sinai, chapter 33, 15 to 16. Can somebody else read that, please? Yes, please.
And he said to him, "If your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight and I your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?"
What does Moses say is going to make Israel distinct from all other nations? He says it's God's panim. I'm going to come back to that very, very important word, but it means on the face level, his face, his countenance, his presence. So what is it that makes Israel unique? It's the presence of God, and not just the presence of God, because that's not clear enough. Panim is his gracious presence, his shining face, in the terms of the previous session. God's panim, which goes with it. What distinguishes Israel from all the nations of the world is God's presence with Israel. Their access to the face of God, the panim of God. Last one. We could look at many other passages which deal with slightly different aspects, but I'm just picking the ones from Exodus. Chapter 34, verse 10. A short reading. Somebody read.
And he said, "Behold, I am making a covenant. Before all your people I will do marvels, such as have not been created in all the earth or in any nation. All the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you."
Right, God is, and it's very packed here, and I can't go into all the... God is going to make his covenant with his people. And the verb here that's used is he's going to create, bara, the same verb that's used in Genesis 1. He's going to create something unique. So the making of the covenant with his people means that he creates something unique, miraculous. And he does something miraculous with his people that's going to be seen by all the nations and astonish them, surprise them, amaze them. Now, if you read the context of that, it's interesting what is the unique work that God is going to do with his people. This comes as the culmination of the incident of the golden calf. And which is chapters 32 to 34. You remember the Israelites made the golden calf. God wanted to wipe out Israel. And then Moses, in four great intercessions, saves the people. He pegs God back. Great intercession. God says, "I want to make a new nation out of you, Moses." Technically speaking, you know, to be within his promises. So you have a flesh start beginning with Moses. And Moses says, "No way, Jose. I'm not going to go in on that deal. It's either them or nothing. It's not me." And God, amazingly, goes along with Moses. But the problem is nothing's been solved. You have a rebellious people, a holy God, which is a recipe for
disaster.
And the second intercession Moses offers to give his life as a sacrifice to atone for the people. And God cuts him short and says, "No, that's no option." And the third intercession then, Moses uses his standing with God to plead for God's panim, his presence with the people. Now this is getting a bit touchy. God's happy for him to go along with Moses, but not with his people. And Moses then intercedes with God and gains God's presence with his people. However, there's a problem. If you have a holy God with sinful Israel, recipe for annihilation, disaster. And then Moses asks God to show him his glory. God, instead of keep showing the glory, gives him his name. And then you have the fourth intercession, where Moses takes God's promise of his name, uses his access to the name to gain God's pardon and forgiveness. And God agrees with Moses' request. So what is the miraculous new thing in human history that God creates here that he's never created before?
Forgiving iniquity?
It's forgiving iniquity. That God, through his institution of the divine service, the sacrifices of atonement, makes it possible for him as a holy God to live with a sinful, unclean people. And the means by which he does that is by establishing the divine service. We'll come back to that. So this is something new. What makes Israel unique? You'd expect with the law that they were a morally or spiritually superior people. That's the normal Protestant story. But no, Israel, the Old Testament, picking the Pentateuch, makes it quite clear that Israel is no better morally or spiritually than the pagan people. What's the difference? But the difference is God and God's covenant with them and God's choice of them and God's gift to them of atonement for sin and everything that has to do with that. Opening up stuff, I'm going to unpack that in the days to come. Okay, now, more generally, then, is for what purpose did God make Israel his holy people? Quite simply, it was for them to do, if you like, what Moses does to them. They have access to God's blessings. The result of atonement, the result of the divine service, was that they have access to God, access to God's blessings, that they can receive from God. And they can mediate God's blessings as a priestly people to all the nations of the earth. The first one we've already had a look at, you will be a holy people. What's the function of them as a holy people? To be a royal priesthood, priests standing between God and the nations, representing the nations before God and bringing God's blessing from God's presence, their access to God's presence, to the nations. The first one, let's go to chapter 20:24, a very, very important passage in the theology of worship. It sums up very simply. So why did the Israelites go to the tabernacle or temple for worship? The simple answer they give, they go in order to receive God's blessing. Here you have it. Todd, could you read chapter 20, verse 24?
An altar of earth, you
shall... Well, just read that in what leads up to it, too, if you don't mind.
23.
Yes.
Well. You shall not make gods of silver to be with me, nor shall you make for yourself gods of gold. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, and your peace offerings, your sheep, and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you.
So, the reason for establishing the altar of the tabernacle, and then later the altar of the temple, is for the Israelites to present their offerings to God in the divine service. And what's the purpose of presenting the offerings to God? It's sacramental, so that God will come to them and do what? Bless them. So what's the purpose of the Israelites being a holy priestly people? It's to receive God's blessing and bring God's blessing to the nations of the earth. Remember God's promise to Abraham? Through you, your seed, what?
All the nations of the earth.
All the families of the earth will be blessed. Ethnic groups of the earth will receive blessing. They will bless themselves or they'll receive blessing. So that promise is beginning to be fulfilled with the establishment of the divine service. Okay, pause. Any questions, observations? Yes.
Do modern, I always hear of the importance of the Jews' land. Is that just a modern interpretation? You talked about what makes Israel a unique nation, and you mentioned geography.
Yeah.
Is there a modern movement towards stressing that the uniqueness of Israel is about the land?
That tends to be Zionism, which is political,
okay,
rather than religious. There are some groups which see that as the core business. But you realize that even after Jesus, Israel has survived amazingly without priesthood, without temple, without kingship, without political system, without any geography. Survived for 2,000 years. Why? They don't even have a temple. They have the law and they have the synagogue. So it's still Israel to the present. In the present day, is predominantly a liturgical community, but a different liturgical community to the one that God established here at Mount Sinai. Why can't they have temple? Why can't they have priesthood? Why can't they have the divine service? Because it can only be in one place. Which place is it? The Dome of the Rock, the second most important Mohammedan shrine, the place where Muhammad ascended into heaven. There's no way, as long as you still have any Muslim alive, that they'll ever be able to build a temple there again. So, the emphasis on land and return to the land tends to be, unlike your fundamentalist, tends to be the less liberal religious and Zionists, which are basically secular Jews. And for the secular Jews, the defining characteristic is land now, and not Torah, the law. Anything else? That shows how much all this stuff is alive, by the way, to the present day. What I'm touching on is not just ancient history, it's what drives politics in the Middle East, in many ways, this question of what makes Israel, unique, special, God's people, and what's their function. Now, to summarize this introductory session, and I might just be able to get through this. As you know, the name Exodus means journey out. Olos is journey, ex is journey out. At the heart of the first part of the book of Exodus is the deliverance from Egypt. Now, the question that I want to consider is, what's the purpose? For what reason did God deliver his people from Egypt? Was it just to set them free? No. The purpose is, if I can use what I think, is liturgical. The purpose is liturgical. He delivers them from Egypt so that he can give them the divine service and they have access to him in the divine service. If you want to put it in modern Christian terms, what is the purpose of evangelism? What's the purpose of baptism? Is to bring people into the divine service. Not just an earthly service, but the heavenly service, the heavenly liturgy. Now, coming coming out of this, then, you have the book of Exodus is, if you like, an elaborate pun. Pun is a play of on words, on a set of Hebrew terms. And I give them here to you, for those of you who have Hebrew, it doesn't matter whether you have it or not. You all know that, those of you who've done some Hebrew, that the base vocabulary of Hebrew is very, very small, which means that most Hebrew words have a far wider semantic range than anything in English. We have a huge vocabulary in English, so huge that most of us don't know it or don't use it, and if we use it, we abuse it. Hebrew has a smaller vocabulary, and words have a wider range of meaning. Now, the key verbal root here is the word which has to do with, you know, what we'd say, serve. Okay? Now, avav is the verb. What does avav mean? To work. It's to work. So, in the book of Genesis chapter 2, God put Adam in the garden to avav it and to guard it. Avav means to work it, cultivate it. So that's its base meaning, is to work, and probably in the sense of it's an agricultural term, to work the land, and to work the land in order to produce crops and animals and that kind of stuff. Avav. But then it's also, later in history, the term for what a slave does. So avav, to avav means to be a slave, to serve as a slave. But notice still that the primary focus here is not on the social status of slave, but the work that's done. By the way, if you wanted to get the modern equivalent of slaves in Israel and much of the ancient world, don't think of your gang slaves, Negro slaves down the south here, but think in terms of basically employees or servants in, in an English house. To be a slave, to serve as a slave. And then it can be to work with someone. So David serves the Lord. It doesn't mean just he works, but he works together. It doesn't just mean that he works for the Lord, but he works together with the Lord. He's a co-laborer. Co-worker. So David is the servant of the Lord, means that he is God's deputy. He is his agent. He is his minister, God's representative, the one who's in charge of God's business. Now, the next one are the ones that I'm interested in. In the ancient world, what we would sociologically call ritual, the term for ritual is work. The gods, you see, are a leisure class, and they require human beings to do the dirty work for them. They are bludgers. They have a good time of it. And according to Babylonian myth, Enuma Elish, the reason that the gods created human beings was to be temple slaves. To do the work for them. Well, what work do human beings to do? God? Gods need houses, they need clothes, above all, they need food. So what do human beings do in worshipping gods is to provide them with food and entertainment. So the necessities for life and the entertainment that they have. If gods didn't have human beings to do the work for them, what would happen to the gods? That star that ceased to exist, or at least they'd shrink and their power, their influence would diminish. So the more people you've got working for you, the more food you've got, the more resources you've got, the more powerful you become in the pantheon of the gods. So worship, to use a modern term, in the pagan world, was to provide the god with the necessities and luxuries for God, for their existence. So it's to do ritual work, serve the gods, but basically by providing food and clothing for them. Now, and then from what's interesting is that the Old Testament takes that term and turns it around. And there's a bit of an argument here that you'll need to follow, which is very important for our Lutheran heritage. This is the term that's used for what we would call worshipping God. Now, if there's one word that I'd like to banish from the English language, theologically, it's the term worship. It is totally inadequate, misleading, and if I can advise you, use it as little as possible, and wherever you use it, make sure you explain what you mean. The biblical term for what is worship, and you'll find most Bibles translate that, is avath, which means to serve. Wherever you have just, there's two different verbs that are translated by worship. There's the one, serve the Lord, translated, worship the Lord. And there's another one, hishtachava, which means to prostrate yourself in front of God. Now, prostrate means going flat on your face with it.
It was in the Benedictus this morning.
Serve him without fear. And it's not the word that's used in Greek, do leo, but it's latroio, which means to do, that's the term that's used there in the Benedictus, to do a ritual service, to perform divine service. Now, to worship the Lord, to serve the Lord. Now, here you get a funny switch. You serve the Lord by presenting food and meat, flour, olive oil, wine. On the face of it, it looks just like the old pagan story. You're providing food for God. But that food is not brought into the holy place. It's not presented to God. It's brought into God's presence in order to do what? To make it holy in order to provide food for the priests and the people. So you serve God by providing food for God, to God, food for you to eat, the wine for you to drink. And it's not ordinary food, but it's God's food, it's holy food. There's much more to it than that, but that's the verb, and we'll come at the way it's being used. And the noun from that is avodah. It means, it's used in Exodus for bondage. Now, the Israelites were in avodah, slavery, in Egypt. They were in bondage. But it's also the word for work. The Levites were appointed for the avodah of the tabernacle, which means to do the work around the tabernacle. Just work. But most importantly, and the further you get to the New Testament, the more clearly this third sense is established, it's to do ritual work, divine service. And that is the preferred Lutheran term traditionally until modern times. Lutherans didn't speak about worship. That's the Anglo-Saxon Calvinist tradition. And the basic idea, your worship is honouring God. Notice that it's what we do to God. Here, divine service is what God serves us so that we in turn can serve God. We speak about the divine service The Latin for that, by the way, is cultus. Cultus Dei, the service of God. Now, I have the pun. This is a long way into it. Now, the basic pun is this, that the Israelites were slaves originally, performing slave labor for Pharaoh. Now, who does Pharaoh represent? He's the incarnation of the sun god. He embodies all the Egyptian gods. In Christian terms, he is, represents the evil powers. They are in service to Pharaoh, and that service is bondage. That service is death and not life. Remember, they are doomed to extinction with their hard labor. So God rescues the Israelites from the service of Pharaoh in order for them to perform divine service, the service of God. The first part of Exodus deals with their deliverance from the bondage. The second part has to do with God's giving them the means by which they can serve him and the way by which he can serve them. A pun, fundamental pun in the book of Exodus. Now, to unpack that pun a bit, okay, we'll just do a little bit of this. I had hoped to finish it, but whatever. Well, now, there's a nice little, one of the problems with English translations is that they only give the surface of the text. Hebrew, like most ancient texts, are full of word plays, puns, double meanings. So you get layers of meaning. It's very, very subtle communication. Not everything, it's not an, we live in a society where everything's explicit, you explain everything. In Hebrew, in the ancient world, you hint at things so that people will think for themselves and work out for themselves what's going on. We're stupid because we stop people from thinking. We do the thinking for them. The ancient way was that you would encourage, entice people, tempt people to think. And there's a whole different tradition of education. But that's a bit of a rant on my part. Now, there's a very interesting pun on the verb avav that you'll find in the Ten Commandments. Can you go to Exodus chapter 20, verse 5? Exodus 20, verse 5. This is talking about other gods and making images for other gods. What are you not supposed to do to other gods? Could somebody read verse 5 for them? For me, please.
You shall not bow down to them nor serve them.
Righto. You shall not bow down. Bow down is not quite right because it's not just doing this, it's doing this. You shall not prostrate yourself before them. And if you prostrate yourself before them, it means prostrating yourself before an idol of them. You shall not prostrate yourself before an idol of them, and you shall not serve them. Now, what's meant by serving them? On the face of it means that you don't do ritual work for them. You don't provide them with offerings. You don't provide them with offerings, and you don't do the work for them. But in Hebrew, this is written like this. Top of them. Which is, I won't go into it, if any of you are Hebrew buffs, you can look up at yourself, is what scholars call a mixed form. You know in Hebrew, you only have the consonants written, and these squiggles here, this for the sake of you non-Hebrew people, are vowels. Okay, now the vowels that have been added to this form are ambiguous. And the ambiguity is this. You can read it either as a kal, which means you shall not serve them, but the more obvious reading of that pointing is that you shall not, hofal, be enslaved by them. There's something rather nice here, and it's very profound. If you serve any other god except the Lord, what's the result of that?
Slavery.
On the other hand, and this is explicitly stated in a number of places, but in Leviticus, if you serve the Lord, then you will be able to walk with heads held high. Meaning what? You're a free people. So with the service of the Lord comes freedom. With the service of pagan gods or things that aren't gods comes slavery, enslavement. Okay, now what was God's purpose in bringing the Israelites out of Egypt? Can we go to two passages and we'll have to stop there. First of all, can we go to chapter 3, verse 15, which is a part of the call of Moses. Chapter 3, verse 15. Yes. Bless you, stress you. Okay, who's going to read this time? No one.
God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations.
Now that doesn't sound right to me. Exodus 3, is that 15?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's a typo. Can you go to verse 12 and change that? The next one's wrong too, I've got a double typo there. So it's, not that. The previous one, instead of it being 23:34, should be 23:24. So instead of 3:15, it should be, what did I say?
3:12.
Okay. Lead, please.
He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.
Okay, now. What's the purpose of Moses delivering the people from Egypt? To serve God at a particular place on this mountain. And then when Moses comes to the Pharaoh, what is his the demand to Pharaoh? He says, let my people go, release them so that they may
serve
me. That's contained in a nutshell. Release my people, liberate my people, so that they can not live as free agents, do their own things, so that they can serve me. And then this is defined when Moses goes to Pharaoh in two ways. Well, how do they serve God? Okay, let's go to, and I'll stop there, chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1. Once again, read,
afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.
Righto? That they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. By the way, that's much better than most English translations. Now, this has a very exact, precise sense. A hug is a pilgrim festival. I'll just go a little bit over time here to finish this. Hug is a pilgrim festival. Now, you know what a festival is? The emphasis on festival is on eating and drinking. And a festival means holy eating, holy drinking. So this is holding a religious party. But no, that's a bit hippie-ish. no, it means feasting with God as God's guest. Now, what's the idea of pilgrim? Is that you go on a journey to a holy place, to God's presence, in order to have a meal with him as his guest. There were three great pilgrim festivals in the Old Testament. Which are they? Well, three the Israelites only went to the temple three times a year, maybe two times, on the pilgrim festivals. And they were obligated, or the male heads of every family were obligated to come in God's presence three times a year. And it wasn't much of an obligation because anybody likes a holiday and anybody likes to have a good feast. Do you know what those three pilgrim festivals are? Passover. Booths is the third one.
Pentecost.
Passover, spring equinox, that's followed by Pentecost, which is Feast of Weeks, the end of the wheat harvest. And then you have the vintage festival, the end of the agricultural year, in autumn, the autumn equinox. So you have those three pilgrim festivals. So God's Moses comes to Pharaoh and says, let my people go. Remember, these are slaves, so that they can serve me. Okay, explains that, so that they can be my guests and feast with me. So that I can give them the royal treatment, feast with me. Hagag. And it's out there in the desert. It's the wrong place for feasting. You'd expect feasting in Egypt, not in the desert. Thirdly then, what kind of a feasting is it? The verb that's used there is savach, which means to slaughter an animal in order to eat it, basically. You slaughter an animal for religious purposes, draining the blood from it in order to eat the meat from it. So what's the most important part of the meal that they have when they serve God? Is meat, the best possible meat. And you need to realize that this doesn't mean much to us because we eat meat every day, but people in the ancient world would eat meat only on these festivals. It was only royalty and very wealthy people who would eat meat regularly. So God provides food for them. Notice the twist? Instead of them serving God in order to provide a meal, feast for God, God calls them to serve him so that he can provide a meal for them to eat and drink as his guests in his presence. Can you see that notions of what God's doing is taking pagan notions and turning them on their head? We better stop there. We've come to 4 o'clock. And even if you're not exhausted, I'm exhausted.